welcome to all. This January 23rd, 2003 meeting of the House Committee on Water is hereby convened. Good to see you, all of your smiling faces here. I see Representative Cruz is not with us. Just to give you an update, Representative Jensen is recovering from successful bypass surgery. So we wish him the very best. And to share with the committee members, Representative Dingfelder and I will be alternating the chair of this committee in the next few meetings until we're otherwise told differently, or Representative Jensen makes it back in here, and we know that he will, and we're looking forward to that and wishing him a speedy recovery. So with that, we're going to get started. Today we have an informational hearing, which is, I think, is a good thing for those of us who've been around here a bit. Water law and water issues are extraordinarily complicated, and it's good for me to get a continued review of that so that I remember the things I've learned and forgotten in times past. And it's also, I think, will be instructive for members of this committee who have not had an opportunity to serve in the body before. So with that, the chair would like to call and welcome Jeff Huntington, Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Welcome, Jeff. Glad to have you here. And for the record, state your name, please.
Jeff Huntington, Executive Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And it's real good to be here. I'm glad to visit with you this morning. And Chair Jensen and I spoke a little bit about his desires for some things that I cover today, and I'll make sure that I do that because I believe it's part of a broader effort that he has in mind and the committee staff have in mind to, over the next few meetings, bring us through from soup to nuts on the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds and who's involved and how that fits together and what it means to the way the state is approaching natural resource issues. And I'm one piece of that. Because of the way my agency is structured with responsibilities relative to the Oregon Plan, we kind of decided I'd come in and lay a little groundwork today. And I want to take the opportunity to give you more and more and more paper, the way that you're getting from everybody.
Thanks, Jeff,
here.
We really appreciate that.
So I've handed you a packet today. I hope it's in front of your places, and I'll refer to some of them as we go through. And then I'll make every effort I can to come and visit with each of you individually and answer whatever questions come up today. And as I was thinking about this last night, I had laid out the typical agency kind of overview and decided not to do the bells and whistles and all that, and decided just to come and talk. And as I was looking over the points I wanted to make last night, I realized that maybe I should just start at the end first, because I wanted to talk with you a little bit just about some of the big policy issues that are floating around the building and the relationship of the economy and the environment and jobs and watershed enhancement and looking at government in a different way. And so I'm going to spend a few minutes and do that, and then maybe with your indulgence I'll go through some of the nuts and bolts of my agency. The Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, and I'll come back to it, is really, I talk about it as a four-legged stool, as an approach for managing natural resources, a four-legged stool. It's based on agency actions and implementing the existing regulatory baseline for natural resource management. The second leg, then, is premised on investing in voluntary efforts by private landowners to do things that make sense on their land, that help both the environment and their operation, and recognizing that only by having the voluntary restoration activities take place can you accomplish a lot of things that the regulations in the state and federal regulations can never accomplish. And shouldn't even try to accomplish, and that we get much further down the road if people are working in concert and doing things that they believe make sense, and they do it because they want to. And so the Oregon Plan has as its first two legs of the stool that existing environmental laws, but also that overlay of having money available and a support structure available to help landowners do what makes sense on a voluntary level. The third leg of that Oregon Plan stool, and we'll talk about this next week, and I won't spend any time on it really today, is monitoring. we look to monitor how we're all doing in making progress toward the resource goals that are important in any given watershed, with the understanding that if we are continuing to make progress, that we can tie the health of that watershed in sustaining the economies of the localities where that are in that watershed. So in every place in the state, we see that there is an economic component to sustaining watershed health, and that by implementing voluntary restoration actions, we are actually enabling the local economy of the communities, particularly in rural Oregon, to be sustained on a long-term basis without the ups and downs of federal mandates and regulatory overlays that cannot possibly be tailored to fit local circumstances. The third leg of the stool for the Oregon Plan to me is then science oversight, and it is the notion that we have an independent science panel, who you will probably hear from next week, that takes a look at how the different programs that are being implemented are going. And they give feedback in a very independent way about whether there's good science that is the underpinning for policy decisions and investments and other decisions that state and federal agencies are making that affect Oregonians and their watersheds. Now, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board really has responsibility for implementing or working on two legs of that four-legged stool: the voluntary restoration piece and coordinating the monitoring efforts that are happening. There are a lot of other agencies that are implementing regulatory programs, and there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people working on the voluntary restoration actions, but OWEB acts as a sponsor or a funder of that leg of the stool. So I'll spend my time today talking about my particular charge as an agency. And when I talk to folks that haven't met me or haven't worked with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, I frequently say that we really are much more like a private foundation than a state agency. We're a private foundation. We're a foundation that has an endowment of funds that were set aside by the voters of the state in Measure 66 several years ago, saying they wanted a certain percentage of lottery funds to be used to improve salmon habitat, enhance water quality, and work toward having sustainable watershed health. And OWEB really is a grant program, a competitive grant program. No regulatory programs. I have no regulatory authority, and I have no implementation of programs by my staff. I consider grants that come in the door that are sponsored by local entities and on behalf of landowners and landowners themselves that come in and say, we want to take a project on. It's a voluntary project, and here's the benefits to our watershed, and here's the match money that I've come up with, and will you fund it? And if we put it through a scientific review and a review process and a citizen boards that discusses the grant proposal, and then we make awards, and then we administer those grants, and we don't do the projects, but we try to make sure that the projects are properly designed and have a technical basis, so that when we monitor the long-term outcomes over time under the Oregon Plan, that we see these projects making concrete contributions toward improving watershed health. I frequently say to folks that we fund products, not programs, and we work toward funding outcomes, and that is how my agency is. It continues to be structured and function to attempt to promote innovation and voluntary action by folks that want to take it on and think it's meaningful in their community and their watershed to do it, and then to roll up those results so that everyone can see how they fit into the bigger picture of the statewide policy. I've been listening to the governor and his new natural resource advisor, who I hope you have met, and if you haven't, I believe is going to come next week and talk to you about the Oregon Plan some. And many of many of you all in the legislative branch speak of the situation the state's facing and where we're headed and what's happening and what's on our plate. And there are a lot of themes and words that are repeated there. You know, we're not going to be able to do things the way we've always done them. We have to have understand that jobs in the economy have to have a direct tie to every program in the state and to the environment in particular when it comes to discussing the natural resource programs. I know that Jim Brown is very fond of saying that it's not the environment or the economy, it's the environment and the economy, and I agree with that, and that drives us toward looking for win-win solutions rather than a command and control traditional approach of identifying where we're going and expecting everyone to line up behind you and move there. And when you talk about the environment and the economy, that to me is implicitly saying that we've looked for solutions that work both for the economic health of the community or the watershed as well as sustaining the long-term environmental objectives that public policy says are important to all of us. And also, we have been talking a lot in the last few weeks about really placing a premium on the responsiveness of government and innovation and seeking out innovation. And I bring these up today because I joined OWEB 3 years ago when it was created, and times were a lot different, but I came to OWEB because of how unique it is in state agencies and because it really, to me, represents a lot of those things. As I've said, we invest in products and not programs, so we look for foreseeable outcomes, and we try to do that in the context of looking for projects where they should be and where citizens want them, and letting the local citizens and local groups define what needs to be done and how best to do it. We make the dollars available to them to do that. When I grabbed hold of a broad look after being in my agency a couple of years, about a year and a half ago, I asked the University of Oregon to come in and take a look at our grant files and see where we were spending money and how that related to local economies. And I'll come back to this later. But generally speaking, when we invest a dollar of public funds in watershed restoration efforts in Oregon through the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, there's a 2-to-1 match of private investment that is also comes with those dollars that we spend. And so every dollar we spend is generally across the board matched it better to 2-to-1. And when the University of Oregon came in and looked at our grant files, they told us that 80% of every dollar that's spent in watershed health grant program that OWEB administers stays in the county and the economy of the county where it's spent, and 95%+ stays in the state. And that 80% level was a little higher than I would have guessed, and I thought it was a real interesting statistic. But they went on and they said, well, and you can generally assume that when looking at the types of activities that OWEB invests in, that when we invest a dollar that is matched by $2, the 80 cents of which stays, 80 cents of every one of those dollars which stays in the county, that on average $1.68 to $2.50 of additional money is spent in the county as an indirect result of the investments in watershed restoration efforts by people that are the direct grant recipients, buying supplies, hiring contractors, doing the work. That results in a multiplier effect of somewhere in that range of $1.68, $2.50. So when I look at that and multiply it out by the millions of dollars that are at work in this state to promote salmon habitat, improve water quality, and have sustainable watersheds, the economic impact of the Oregon plan right now is significant. And it is not occurring in every single instance, but on average, we can really talk about an economic stimulus that occurs from making these investments in local groups that are working on the ground with landowners voluntarily. And that's an important piece of the environment and the economy win-win philosophy that I think we're all talking about. And it really is innovative. It's striking to me as I travel to other states and talk to people in Washington, D.C., as we seek to have federal money come into the state, how truly innovative Oregon's approach of having voluntary watershed restoration activities by watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts, how innovative it is and how unique it is seen by other places. And yet in Oregon, it's become commonplace enough that I was reading an editorial a couple of months ago, and the person that wrote the editorial identified themselves. It was a letter to the editor, not an editorial, a letter to the editor, identified themselves as a watershed council member. And it wasn't about watershed council. It wasn't about watersheds. It was a letter about budget or some unrelated thing. But they identified themselves as the chair of such and such watershed council. And I thought that was a very interesting comment about how commonplace and how integrated this whole notion is of having local groups work with landowners. So that was some of the messages I wanted to talk about after the overview of my agency, but I thought I just couldn't start out without that kind of context. And I'll be happy to discuss things more with you as we go forward. Representative Jensen and I, Chair Jensen and I, talked about giving you a thumbnail sketch of the policy role of OWEB, an evolution of how we have come to where we are today, and then the nuts and bolts of what we do today, which is essentially a grant program that administers lottery funds and federal funds on the order of about $20 million a year, with providing transparent fiscal accountability to the public, the Secretary of State's office, the governor, the legislature, where that money's going, why it's going, and how is it being spent, and then our Oregon plan role. I've touched on a lot of things that relate to our policy role, but essentially it's our investments in local sponsored voluntary projects that are aimed at fish habitat, water quality, watershed enhancement. We have a function that is to integrate and cut across all the agencies that are involved in natural resources with the express charge legislatively to facilitate whatever we can do to help agencies collaborate to move Oregon from a silo approach of managing resources to integrating policies so that we don't talk about water quantity separate from water quality, separate from wetlands, and separate from forest practices, but that where we can, we talk about how to integrate natural resource issues in the state on a local level so that they are taking on what needs to be done in a local watershed or at a basin level, a basin scale. We are part of a larger shift in the focus of Oregon natural resource policy, and that's to have that local delivery system for effectuating changes in practices and stewardship on private lands. And the watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts are my constituencies. They are key to making this work. They are actually the reasons that Oregon's natural resource framework is working today. And I'll talk to you a little bit about them, but we're going to make sure that a couple of them get in here next week to talk to you about how they integrate into the Oregon plan. The end notion for OWEB always is that we have to move from a place where Oregonians are encouraged or are put in the position of fighting over the last drop of water or the last fish or the last, and you fill in the blank, whatever it is that relates to natural resources, and try to have resources that are available to implement solutions that will let landowners move to a place where there is a cooperative solution among all the interests in a basin. And I won't spend time going through it, but I'll talk to you individually later. This is the strategic plan that the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, my citizen oversight board, worked on. It is 2 years old, but it is just as much an operative document for us today as it was the day that we built it. Every meeting is built around the three outcomes that are in here and the strategies for implementing those outcomes. And if you don't do anything else, the inside cover can show you a good sense of how my Citizen Oversight Board sees where it's going and what its contribution to Oregon should be in terms of effective and accountable investments in watershed health, promoting partnerships, and increasing citizen understanding of watershed health. And the strategies that we try to implement in a broad scale are then identified in 11 points next to those outcomes. And my board works in subcommittees that are built around those strategies. One thing I did put in your packet that I'll call your attention to and talk to you for just a second about is a single page that's a map of the state of Oregon. And it has the citizen members of the OWEB board. And to understand OWEB, that's a good place to start. We have a board that is different than other natural resource boards. I have a 17-member board that oversees the agency. 11 of those members are directly appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate in one fashion or another, and I'll explain that. We have five members that come to the OEB board because they sit on the policy commissions of other natural resource, state natural resource boards and commissions. The Board of Forestry has a member on OEB board, Fish and Wildlife Commission, Department of Environmental Quality, Water Resources Commission, and the Board of Agriculture. So each of those agencies has their own citizen oversight board, and each of them sends one of their citizen board members to serve on OEB. The governor then, and all of those folks, go through an appointment process related to their home board or commission. The governor then appoints, and the Senate confirms, six additional citizens at large to serve on OEB's board. And this map shows you some of the citizens that and the locations of where they come from. One of those citizens by statute has to be a representative of tribal governments in the state. The others represent a diverse set of interests, and I'll show you a place where you can get a thumbnail sketch of what they do, but I have board members that come that range from county commissioner, former county commissioner in Lake County and Wallowa County, rancher, CEO of Fortune 500 company, the ex-dean of the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. So from all walks of life, and they come and they operate almost always on consensus and are responsible for every funding decision that the board, that OEB makes, and every dime that we administer. If there aren't any questions so far, and if you still want to hear more from me, then I'll talk to you a little bit about the evolution from the how we came to have an Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. It's not new. Watershed restoration efforts and the governor's Watershed Enhancement Board, the program has been around since 1987. We're 15 years old. And because of a lot of changes that have occurred in the last few years, I think that all of us forget that this is a long-standing commitment that Oregon's made since the late 1980s. It started out in 1987 when the legislature identified three problems they wanted addressed in the management of natural resources in Oregon. And they were essentially the belief that eight resource agencies were addressing particular land uses separately, and each one was doing it in a vacuum, and there was some desire to coordinate the efforts to address the health of the resource as a whole. That local communities needed more control and say in that, and that regulation of resources alone wasn't the answer, and that once resource problems were identified, another mechanism had to exist to help take on those problems. And that was the essence of where everything that's happening today started 15 years ago, was the identification of those things. And in response to that, the legislature and the governor created what was called the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board. And the mission was to provide outreach and assistance to landowners, to work with federal and state natural resource agencies across bureaucratic boundaries to achieve watershed management goals instead of particular program missions. And OEB funded landowner workshops and education activities, provided grant funding of about $500,000 to $1 million a biennium for demonstration projects that were seen as ways to demonstrate what could occur if we empowered local groups and citizens to invest in their watershed activities. So at a demonstration level and at an educational level, that's where things started in 1987. In 1992, there was an attempt to modify that and to try a different approach that would be more targeted, and the Watershed Health Program was born. That identified two areas of the state and targeted forming watershed councils to pilot programs that would establish in all over the state watershed councils, but in two particular parts of the state, the Northeast and in the Southwest, targeted investments with a fair amount of money being made available to do some specific, take on some specific goals in those two parts of the state. By 1995, the lessons learned from that watershed health program and some of the educational and groundwork activities that OWEB had done, or GWEB had done, Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board had done on a demonstration basis, took hold, and there was a move toward having watershed councils begin to represent a variety of interests in local communities across the state. And by the end of 1997, we had 60 watershed councils formed statewide. And there were programs and activities occurring both by districts and councils all over the state instead of in two focused portions of the state. And to become eligible for state funding, the statutes that were in place and still are today said that the watershed councils had to be locally based and they had to be voluntary, and that the county commission had to identify that they were representing a balance of interested and affected persons within the watershed. Over time, councils have formed and grown. We have about 93 councils today. That's leveled off and really hasn't changed since I've come to OWEB by very much at all. They look different in different parts of the state, predictably. They take on different roles and different functions in their different watersheds depending on what the issues are that are there and what the local makeup of the community is in the interest of the landowners. And they work with soil and water conservation districts. Some councils work very directly with soil and water conservation districts. Some work in tandem, but in parallel. Some don't have great relationships with soil and water conservation districts because of local issues. But I'm seeing that the trend is that we are merging, and in a way that we have a lot of congruent interest between two very key delivery mechanisms that help private landowners. And I'll talk a little bit about soil and water conservation districts here in a minute, and watershed councils some more, and I'm sure that you have questions about them. In 1995, something big happened in the state, and that was the proposed listings of some of the salmon stocks. And by 1997, then Governor Kitzhaber and the legislature had decided to create and put in place the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. And that meant there was a significant emphasis that was placed on the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board and the local watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts to grab hold of actually implementing a piece of statewide natural resource policy instead of programs that made sense locally but hadn't been knit together into a formal piece of state natural resource policy. A year later, another significant event happened in 1998. Oregon citizens passed ballot measure 66. And ballot measure 66 amends the Oregon Constitution to set aside 15 cents of every lottery dollar, half of which goes to parks for acquisition and maintenance of parks and is administered by the Oregon Parks Department, and half of which goes to, by constitutional amendment, a single state agency who will administer that money for restoration and protection of salmon habitat, water quality, and watersheds. And so a substantial funding source, an endowment that I mentioned earlier, was put in place by the Oregon voters in 1998. And in 1999, also in the context of this umbrella of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, OWEB was created as a cabinet-level agency from the program, the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board, that had existed prior. And OWEB was identified as the single state agency called for in the Constitution to administer this endowment of lottery funds and other funds that would support the Oregon Plan efforts. And therein lies where we are today in the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds and the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board having a role in taking on that second leg of the stool, the voluntary restoration actions. In the last legislative session, there were some bills passed, two bills in particular, Senate Bill 945 and 946, and they didn't change the funding structure at all, but they moved some Oregon Plan responsibilities to OWEB to administer. the third leg of the stool, or in Watershed Enhancement Board, was vested with the responsibility by statute to coordinate the monitoring of how we're all doing on in implementing the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. And that's a coordination function because that includes water quality monitoring that's being done by our by the Department of Environmental Quality, water quantity tracking that's being done by the Water Resources Department, fish distribution and habitat monitoring, of course, being done by the Fish and Wildlife Department. And so OWEB really tries to knit those together to provide a way to depict it for reporting to the governor and legislature and the public on how things are going. And that was that, along with one other statutory charge in the 2001 session, brings together OWEB's responsibilities as they stand today. And that last legislative charge was to have OWEB attempt to take on the standardization of data that natural resource agencies are collecting. And in, and we exist in a state where, through history and the way we budget and investments, we have silos of information about water quality and water quantity and where the fish are and where the roads are, and very difficult task ahead of us to try and knit those together in the same scale and make them accessible to citizens that would like to sit or similar conservation districts or anybody that would like to be in their watershed, be able to get on the internet, identify the basin they live in, the watershed they live in, and see what information is available about the status of key indicators like water quality and where the water diversions are and where the culverts are that might impact fish passage and things like that. And that's a long-term project, but in the 2001 session, OWEB was asked to begin to chip away at that and by bringing the collaboration of our sister agencies to the task. I want to come back for just a minute to
Members, do we have any questions?
Yeah, I'd love
to Jeff at this point in time.
I have one.
Mike,
sure. Here. Is that economic stimulus information in here?
Yes, it is. And I will point out two things that we put in for you, and I'm glad you asked the question. There's a one-pager that talks about Oregon watershed restoration projects assessed. It's an article that was published last month based on excerpts from a speech I gave to the councils and districts in November. There's one other piece, though, that is maybe more important and that directs your goes directly to your question, Representative. It's a packet, stapled packet. And each of you have in this, we have broken out OWEB's investments county by county in this state. And each of you, I believe, have the counties that are within your district at least, and maybe the full packet in front of you. It's a one-page sheet. On the front of it, you should be able to look and identify specifically the number of projects and the amount of investment OWEB's made in that county, the total match funding that came from private sources that matched those investments, and how that relates to the OWEB region at large and statewide. And then some of the basic information I gave you about the study that the University of Oregon conducted on the multiplier effect of that and how much stays in the county, and then a list of the districts and the councils that are in that county. And on the back of that sheet is a printout, and one of the things that I can always offer to this committee or any of its members is information on specific projects, specific activities that comes from our grant database. And essentially what we did was we printed out an example from our database of the types of projects we funded in the county that's on the front part of the page. And so you can see who the grantee was, how much OWEB invested, what the total project costs, and just a two-sentence project summary, just to give you a sense of the kind of work these local restoration groups are doing in that part of the state. And this is something that we produced not just in preparation for the session, but because we have 146-some local restoration entities all around the state that want to better be able to talk about how they're contributing to overall state natural resource policy and asked me to give them some tools so they could talk to Rotary clubs and chambers of commerce and other citizen groups about what they were doing. There's one last piece, Representative, that's in your packet that is not directly on the economic piece, but it's something that I might as well talk to you about right now. And this is a portfolio of projects that we have put together. Principally, we use it when we're attempting to find private foundation money that we can leverage to match the public dollars that we've been charged with, or when we're working to secure federal funds to come to the state of Oregon. We put this together. We're very proud of it. This is a portfolio that goes basin by basin through the state. So you can look at the Willamette Basin or the Klamath Basin, whatever, and see dots on the map of where we had projects in the last 2 years, not cumulatively, some basic basin facts and stories about three projects that are happening. And just to get a sense of the kinds of things that come across the OWEB as an agency in our grant cycles and the kinds of projects that are going on all over the state. And it is very interesting to look at this basin by basin, because it's very different types of work that are happening in different parts of the state, as it should be.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Jeff, I have a question for you regarding the grant application process. And I know you handed out this single sheet, but I get asked a lot of questions about the grant review process, and maybe you could just walk the committee briefly through how you process and review grants, and maybe just sort of walk
us
through.
That would be great. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder. I'm being a little informal this morning. I apologize. We had a baby in our house last night that made it his business to keep both my wife and I active at several points in the evening. So I'm a little short on sleep, and that means that I get a little informal, and I apologize if I overstep the boundaries of decorum here. Yes, I would be happy to talk about the grant program. And there are two parts to our grant program: awarding grants and tracking them, and being and the fiscal management of the grants. We have three grant cycles a year right now, and one of the things that, and Representative Dingfelder, with your permission, I will at least set the stage by talking about where the funds come from, because it really affects how we review grants. Measure 66 set aside 7.5 cents of every dollar to be used on watershed restoration efforts, but half of that money, a little over half, 65% actually, is dedicated in the Constitution with a requirement that be spent on the ground projects, capital expenditures, I call them, projects that are actually going to be implemented in some fashion, as opposed to monitoring and technical assistance and natural resource staff people and things like that. So 65%, and that is the bulk of our grant program. It amounts to about $30 million a biennium, or $15 million a year, has to be spent on capital projects that advance salmon habitat, water quality, or watershed restoration. So the first thing we do when we get applications that come in the door is we divide them into those applications that are seeking money for projects on the ground and those applications that are seeking money for what I call capacity, which is the ability to provide technical assistance to design projects, monitoring what's going on, education and outreach activities that support watershed restoration efforts, those kind of things that aren't actual on-the-ground projects. We send those two clumps of applications then immediately out to five regional teams and each of the OWEB regions, and the board member sheet identified five OWEB regions: North Coast, South Coast, Willamette, the center of the state from Hood River down through Klamath, Central Oregon, and then Eastern Oregon.
Jeff, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Jeff, can you clarify who's, because I one thing that you didn't mention, who is eligible for the grants? I think it's important.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder.
A lot.
Virtually anyone in the state is eligible to apply for a grant, except for federal and state agencies who are eligible to apply for a grant but must do so as a co-applicant with someone else that is also eligible. So the bulk of our business is really with watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts, who act as the delivery mechanism to find the projects, find the people, design the projects, get the permits, apply for the funds, get the work crew on site for a landowner so that the rancher can continue ranching but can have the fence project done. But we also have projects that come from county commissions, universities, city governments, and individual landowners as well as private nonprofit groups. The Nature Conservancy or Ducks Unlimited also participate in the grant program.
Thank you.
When we send these out to the regional review teams, the regional review teams are comprised of not OWEB employees. They are set up by discipline. So we try to have a fish biologist, a forest practices expert, an agricultural practices expert, a water allocation expert in the room, and we also try to get a geographic distribution. Our goal is to have every discipline that might be involved in doing a technical assessment of a project, particular project application, present, but also someone in the room that has personal knowledge on the ground with field expertise from virtually every watershed or every part of the region that's involved. Those regional review teams do not have to be comprised of public agency people. They can be a mix. We try to broaden it out, and actually that's one of the places where we're trying a little harder, in fact, to broaden it out and have more private consultant presence on our review teams. But generally we have a mix of federal agency and state agency and depending on the part of the state, some local agency folks sitting on these regional review teams because of their expertise, not because of their affiliation. They do a technical review of every application in their region. They look to see if this is a well-designed, technically appropriate project. And then second, they look to see if this is even if it is well-designed and technically appropriate, if it is proposed to be implemented in a place that will really make a difference to accomplish what it's supposed to accomplish. And then they look at the budget to see if overall it is within the realm of what the cost should be and if there are components that are appropriate to taking on what is being requested and what's being planned. They make a recommendation on every application, and we get, through three cycles, about 140 applications a cycle. And divide those up. They send them all back to, as that review is occurring, that recommendation is arrived at by a group process of ranking applications. The OWEB staff facilitate the meeting but don't have a vote. We're the only ones in the room that don't have a say, actually, on whether the project's going to be recommended for funding or not. When they reach their funding recommendation on every project, they then do a ranked order of the highest priority, and they give the OWEB board a sense of if you have to draw lines because of budget limitations, what's the most important projects to get done, and they just really give a rank order. My staff writes up a review sheet that tries to synthesize the conversation, the review team, and discuss why things were funded, issues that came up, how to make the project better if there are any conditions. We compile those review sheets. I put together with my staff the budget. My board tries to allocate funds so that we have as much at the end of the budget biennium as at the beginning. So we set a budget for what the board, we recommend they spend at a particular meeting, and then my board convenes four times a year. And they go through region by region, those applications, looking at the recommendations, and they vote out projects. Mostly we do that in a block unless there's particular issues that crop up. We had a board meeting last week. The board heard testimony from grant applicants for about 3 hours and then discussed the project applications on deck for about another 3 hours and ended up voting on about $4 million worth of project applications in the course of that 2 days. And it was a pretty thorough ringing out by the time it was all over. And I can tell you that as citizens, they have heard the message that they're responsible for making sure that when people are looking back on this program, that there is an understanding of why we spent the money, where we spent it, and what was accomplished for it. And they remind me of that frequently, and that's where those questions go. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, does that adequately cover the review process in your question?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if there's any other questions about it. Thank you.
To give you just a sense of the numbers that we see in our application process, in the last biennium, in this 2001-2003 biennium, we funded about 395 out of 932 grant applications that were submitted to us. It was about 42% of the applications that were filed were funded or partially funded. We awarded about $30 million in grants this biennium and invested about an additional $15 million in monitoring efforts and technical assistance to landowners and in Oregon Plan data-related products. The way my grant program is structured now, because of the limitations on the lottery dollars, the on-the-ground projects are usually funded out of lottery dollars. The 35% that isn't limited by the Constitution to be spent on capital-type projects that I mentioned earlier has been budgeted to help accomplish other components of the Oregon Plan and supports water quality both through the Senate Bill 1010 and TMDL development in those two agencies and some biologists and a variety of different programs that support the Oregon Plan. But I don't give any of the non-capital lottery money out as grants. My program, when I issue grants for monitoring and education and technical assistance to landowners, it's 100% federal funds right now. And part of the recognition of the Oregon Plan in the last few years has been Congress identifying that states in the Northwest are struggling to cope with the listing of stocks under the federal fish stocks under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And so there is a program called the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund that is a congressional appropriation on an annual basis that sends money to Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and California and tribal governments to offset and help cope with recovery of listed salmon stocks. The congressional appropriation, by language in the appropriation, Oregon's share comes to the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And in California, Washington, and Oregon, the congressional language identifies the need to have these monies overseen and administered or tracked by a citizen oversight board. So Oregon was all set up with a mechanism to take these federal funds and administer them. And working with NOAA Fisheries, we have terms of our federal grant that I have to comply with that say that that these monies that Oregon receive are to be administered by a vote of the OWEB board and can be integrated seamlessly into the existing watershed restoration rules and grant guidelines of our program here in Oregon. So my grantees that apply for money frequently don't even have to deal with whether they're getting a lottery dollar or a federal dollar. They care about getting the dollars to put on the ground, and we at OWEB take care of the federal reporting requirements and the consultation issues and the things that come along with this federal fund source. But it is a substantial federal fund source for us, and we have called on it, all of us, to help us through tough budget times and to supplement what the lottery funds are providing for watershed restoration activities.
Jeff, Representative Schaffer has a question for you.
Thank you. Johnson Creek runs right through my district, and I can see things going on down there with my eyes. Since 1987, have you got some measurable market information on the improvement of water quality, fish population benefiting from this, things like that, so you can show exactly what we're getting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffer, the answer is yes and no. Great answer. Yes, we do monitoring on every project, so we can show the effectiveness of individual projects in how they're being implemented and whether they're staying intact in flood events and whether they're accomplishing the objectives as a project that they were designed to accomplish. Get rid of a fist passage barrier to allow free access or improve the improve the riparian zone by not having a road cut come right down to the area, whatever the particular project is. The no answer, the no part of the answer, is that when we're talking about recovering salmon stocks and improving water quality over the long term, it is a long-term effort to find out whether the effectiveness, the combined effectiveness of all of the efforts over time are resulting in higher returns of salmon to particular watersheds. We have to look at everything from ocean conditions to harvest and hatchery issues to long-term trends in the habitat factors that might be influencing the stock. So we have a long-term monitoring program that over decades will tell us how our investments in habitat are affecting recovery of stocks as part of the equation of harvest, hatchery, and ocean conditions and the other things that affect returning fish stocks. But in the short term, we can't say that Project A is resulting in X percentage increase in a run to the Johnson Creek watershed, for instance. And that's a difficult hurdle for us to get over. When I talk to groups about habitat and why we should be investing in restoring habitat as part of recovering fish, I talk about it. If I had a whiteboard, it'd be great. But I talk about it. If you had a graph and you had an oscillating line that went up and down, and the graph on the vertical axis was talking about the number of fish, and on the horizontal axis was time, and you would see fish populations go up and down depending on all of the things that affect fish populations. At some level, you could draw a line, a straight horizontal line, and that would be the level that you'd say if the fish population drops below that line, we're going to lose that particular stock. And my 5-cent understanding of fish population dynamics and recovery and all of that is that when we invest in habitat, what we're trying to do is make sure that when ocean conditions are at their worst and we have a drought and we have all the things working against healthy fish populations that we can't control, that we have enough in the bank in habitat that we can keep that line dipping below the place where the stock will wink out. And that habitat plays a key role in being able to do that, and it plays but at the same time, it plays an incremental role in the overall health of the stocks.
In regards to that question, Jeff, I it seems to me that you would be able to quantify some success, though, of some of your projects, if. I'm just thinking off the top of my head, if one of your projects is planting trees along the stream for shade, and supposedly, although it's certainly up for great debate and argument that whether that's really effective or not, but if the shading does create cooler areas of water where fish weren't there before, in your observations or your watersheds observing, you ought to be able to quantify if that was having some positive effect just by observation. You know, hey, there's fish here now when there wasn't before. We had shade, that kind of thing. I know it's really an inexact science in trying to get a sense of whether these dollars that are being invested are really achieving measurable results. How do I, as a legislator, go back to my constituents and say, you know, we're making a difference here? If you can't give me quantifiable evidence that your efforts are really working.
Mr. Chair, I can give you quantifiable evidence that you're seeing fish where you haven't seen them before because fish passage barriers have been removed, or you're seeing you have diversions that are screened now that weren't screened before, and we have increase in salmon refuge by having more estuarine area than we had before, or individual project categories. We can give you statistical information that shows that. It is a different question when we talk about the effectiveness, the overall effectiveness and the contribution to the ebb and flow of fish populations when you roll it up and say, what is everything being done in this particular watershed? What is the impact overall to fish? And one of the things that we will talk about this with the permission of the committee as part of the Oregon Plan presentation, because one of the legs of the stool is monitoring, and effectiveness monitoring is a cornerstone of the plan. One of the things I put in front of you is the biennial report for the Oregon Plan. And there's a four-page spread in there on monitoring, and on this topic in particular, and there will be folks that are much more versed and able to talk to you in specific terms than I, from Fish and Wildlife Department and Kelly Moore, who's charged with coordinating the monitoring. But on page 46 of the implementation report on the biennial for the Oregon Plan, we talk about some specific accomplishments that are occurring as a result of investments being made in watersheds and overall changes to watersheds that we're seeing that we believe can be attributed to in part investments being made in habitat. And these are trends in abundance of coho, fish located now where they weren't before. There's a real interesting map that was produced actually by the Midcoast Watershed Council through a grant that OWEB sponsored on page 47 that shows the Aquinnah Bay Basin and identifies in a bar by bar lines how many fish are in different places of the basin and where those fish are as part of the sampling regime. And we can look there and see where the fish are today as opposed to where they were a number of years ago and correlate that to investments we've made in returning and restoring habitat.
Representative Cruz has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple, one maybe more of an observation that you could comment on, but clearly, if you're speaking specifically of salmon, the relationships of various aspects are so interdependent. And I agree with you, it's hard to pin something on one aspect, whether it be riparian or whatever. But don't we actually have a way we can define success by water quality measurements? Because clearly, there's a very direct relationship between what we do. I mean, most riparian work shows up as water quality improvements, less turbidity, all those factors, and I have yet to have anybody tell me what part of compliance with clean water kills salmon. I don't think it does. So, we do have some things that we can directly measure that are a direct result of a riparian project, but that gets more into Clean Water Act than ESA, doesn't it?
Representative Croft and Representative Cruz, or Chair Croft, Representative Cruz, we invest in projects that look toward improving water quality as part of recovering salmon stocks and also on projects that are designed just to help improve the quality of the stream or the river or the water body as part of having a watershed that can sustain important pieces of the local economy too. So we at OWEB anyway, as part of the charge, it's not always about fish. It's sometimes about making sure that we've got a sustainable track for the resource that is important to that area. There are OWEB projects that are specifically, I'm certain, have come through that are to fund a water quality improvement because it will make a difference for fish. And I can't sit here and talk to you about the specifics of which projects are why, but the essence of your question, I think, is that there is a tie between water quality and fish, and yet there are very concrete ways to measure the quality of water and the indices for deciding what is good water and what's water that's below par.
Right.
And there's a lot of monitoring that's done of that.
Okay.
And the monitoring team for the Oregon Plan has a strong water quality monitoring component that we'll bring to the table next week, and I'll make sure that we come prepared to talk in detail about that point.
Okay. Well, and clearly, if you're doing barrier removals and things like that, that's not a water quality issue. That's an access issue, and so there's
exactly. There's
a clear delineation there. But one, I think, could reasonably assume that anything you're doing, to stabilize stream banks or improve upland stability, turbidity is clearly a significant issue for a lot of reasons, and a lot of our riparian projects deal directly with that sort of issue. I think the first thing we can probably use as a measure of success is impact on quality. And but my other question is, as it relates to the monitoring, DEQ does a lot of stream monitoring. Is that all part of your equation here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, yes.
Okay.
The Oregon Plan Monitoring Team has components from DEQ, Fish and Wildlife, Forestry, the main core agencies and disciplines, and it is integrated together to try and provide a collective picture of what is the effectiveness of everything that's going on in a basin, and with respect to particular components, water quality or fish abundance or basal area in the riparian zone, things like that, all of which have a role.
So one could assume, one more follow-up, Mr. Chair, one could assume, for example, that if you had an RFP for a monitoring study, the first thing you would do would be to look at what other state agencies are doing, if indeed anything, in that area, and see if, number one, if it's duplicative, which would make that project probably not be funded, or if it's not quite duplicative but has some common elements, you would, for example, somebody wants to monitor a stream reach that DEQ is already doing intensive water quality monitoring on. Would it be possible? Would you go to DEQ and say, what about these other elements? Would you be willing to pick that up as part of the project you're currently doing?
Representative, it's a very good question, and the answer is absolutely yes. If we get a grant application in the door, the first place it goes is to this monitoring team that has all of the scientific representatives from the science end of all of the agencies, and they look at it to see how it fits in the comprehensive scheme of moving us down the field toward effectiveness tracking and where it fits and where it doesn't, and then it goes out to the regional teams for review. And I might say that we have programs at DEQ, and I'm seeing more and more the monitoring components of the different agencies are also integrating their individual programs with these watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts around the state because of staffing and because of economies of scale and because it's a great source of ongoing data collection to use these groups. And it also makes sure that the data that's collected, there's local understanding of it, and there's a collaboration of the need for it. DEQ right now works, we fund a voluntary monitoring program, water quality monitoring program. DEQ provides equipment to the local groups and their water quality people train the local groups on how to do water quality sampling so that when the samples are taken that they're of use, not just to the local group, but can also be integrated into the collection that is important to the agency's tracking too.
Okay, Mr. Chair, it'd be nice when we get into that monitoring section when the other folks come in. I guess I would be interested because clearly I think DEQ's monitoring is virtually all aspects of 303, and it'd be interesting to know if there are other components outside of that that also are being considered. 303 is a fairly comprehensive list of water quality standards, so
I will take that as a request from the committee, and we'll make sure that we can touch on that as part of that presentation.
And Jeff, when you do that, be sure that you provide us with the names of the individuals who are on the monitoring team, where they come from, how they're being supported financially. Are they full-time? When do they meet?
Okay.
Just those types of things. It's a mystery to me to whom they are and their structure and so forth, okay. And I'd like to explore that to see what they are.
Mr. Chair, we'll do that.
Thank you.
Standard.
And will you be talking today some about, you provided us with some audit information. Will you perhaps a bit later be sharing some of that information with? I know our Representative Dingfelder has some questions for you in that regard.
Mr. Chair, I was about to ask for permission to move on from awarding grants to talking about the fiscal tracking of grants. And
timing is impeccable.
We're in good shape. Once grants are awarded, we sign a grant agreement with the entity that includes a budget page. Budget pages sometimes that identify components of how the money that is awarded is to be spent, and by categories. And unlike a lot of private foundations, who simply make the award and require proof that the project that they have invested in was completed with some sort of reporting back, but treat it as a lump sum transaction. Because we're dealing with Measure 66 lottery monies and public funds, OWEB works on a reimbursement basis. We will advance a small portion of some portion of the grant to the grant recipient, but we work on a reimbursement basis based on receipts. And so the grantees submit payment requests to us that identify the expenditure and how that relates to a cost category within the budget in the grant agreement that was reviewed all the way back to that regional review team when they were identifying whether the project was at an appropriate scale of money for what was to be accomplished. I have a fiscal staff then that reviews all of those requests for reimbursements and then and talks to the grantee if there's questions, works it out, reconciles it with the grant agreement, and then a payment on the request is cut.
Is that quarterly or as needed?
Representative Cruz, it's as needed at this point. One of the things that we're putting in place now is a request, though, to our grantees that they not go more than 120 days without having that kind of transactions with us so that any advances don't stay out there without having that kind of reimbursement even for longer than 120 days. But we work according to a pace that's good for the councils and the districts, in part because they have to secure permits, they have to secure access, they're working with independent contractors and local contractors and vendors. So every project unfolds according to what is working for these groups that are putting it together. And so we do it on that basis. We hold back the final 10% of every grant until we receive a final completion report on the project that wraps it up and identifies that it was completed as designed and as advertised. And we have a monitoring component that's attached to most projects that requires at some interval of monitoring that makes sense, sometimes up to 5 years, on the effectiveness of the project to provide us with data that we then keep that we can then use as part of this overall monitoring program. We are constantly walking a fine line in my agency between being able to be fiscally accountable and transparent to the Secretary of State's office and to the Department of Administrative Services and to the public and to you all on where the money's going, why, and how much, and also being responsive to what are really, again, local citizen groups, watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts that are not on not full-blown bureaucracies that are geared up to do everything that could be asked of them. So we try to walk that line between making it easy enough that they can do what they need to do in order to give us the capacity to roll it all up and provide the accountability. We're working now with the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, helping to fund a standardized accounting system for every district in the state to use, QuickBooks, so that when they're all keeping books the same way, we're trying to do those kind of things to bring these citizen groups along to have the capacity to participate in. Because remember, we're talking about a program that has grown from these demonstration projects of $500,000 to $1 million a year in the early 1990s to $20 million a year that is going out and on the ground today. And so the fiscal accountability piece of this is huge. And I was going to bring it today and forgot it, but there was a headline long before I ever thought about being in the job I'm in now, that was in the Oregonian one day about the Bonneville Power Administration and where the money had gone and the lack of ability to identify dollar for dollar where it had been spent, why it had been spent there, and what had been accomplished as a result. And I'm mindful of that headline frequently. But that is a large piece of OWEB's function, not to get the project done as much as to make sure that others aren't squelched in their ability to do the project, but that we can turn around, roll it up, and have the accountability for a large investment of public funds. I have a staff in my grant program of 9 people that do the grant program work and 3 people that do the fiscal grant administration piece. And I could put in a 4th person, depending on how I counter, that's administrative support. So that part of my program is very, very lean. One person in each of the 5 regions with a couple of folks that help do the work in Salem, and then the 3 people that process every payment request, and it is thousands of payment requests every year. We are required under the Constitution that passed Measure 66, Constitutional Amendment, to be audited by the Secretary of State's office every other year. The first audit came out, it's in your packet. It is the first full audit of the expenditure of Measure 66 money. It's the second audit that I've had of my agency since I've been there. And the audit says a number of things, but bottom line, it was a clean bill of health for the way the Measure 66 monies are being expended, not just by OWEB, but by every agency that's receiving Measure 66 money, including Parks Department, for their half of the 15%.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I have a question. Jeff, and I don't know if you know the answer to this or we need to get Parks in here, but as I was looking through this, and this is the first time I've seen this audit, it's very helpful. Under the Parks subaccount, I noticed that very few of the Measure 66 dollars have been expended by the end of the biennium. And actually, I'm sorry, I'm looking just at the land acquisition. So that, does that mean that, and this is a question for you, because I do know that land acquisition is a part. I don't know if it's under your subaccount or that's solely under Parks. I guess I'm trying to figure out for the land acquisition portion, and I guess all of it was expended, and I wasn't aware of that. And is that under your subaccount or solely under the Parks? And can you maybe explain for the committee how acquisition fits in, because I do know that was one component of Measure 66. And I'm not clear on that, so it would be very helpful.
Representative Dingfelder, the short answer is that the Parks subaccount is, at least for administrative purposes, entirely separate and segregated from the 7.5% that goes through OWEB. And I don't know the answer to your question about the rollout of the information that was budgeted for the Parks subaccount, but it's administered by the Parks and Recreation Department. And I will probably see the director later today, and I'll mention to him I had a question on it and ask him to contact you if you'd like.
Can I just follow up, Mr. Chair, to clarify?
Yes.
So I guess what I'm trying to just clarify is, are there funds available in your subaccount for acquisition as well, or is it solely under the Parks subaccount?
And Representative Dingfelder, there are funds available for acquisition in my subaccount, and it is part of the program. The ballot measure was constructed so it specifically called out acquisition in the Parks context as a function and purpose of the money. In the salmon restoration watershed enhancement half of the Measure 66 ballot measure, it identified the availability of the funds to be used for acquisition, but did not limit the money to being spent on that, nor did it set aside any percentage of the restoration funds that should be spent on acquisition. And that's a piece in the evolution of the program that I should have mentioned, and I'll go back to. Prior to the creation of OWEB in 1999, as in response to ballot measure 66 in the Oregon Plan and Salmon and Watersheds, the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board did not invest. It was not an eligible grant application to acquire an interest in land or water for salmon habitat or water quality or any other watershed-related reason. The ballot measure specifically identified that the Measure 66 lottery monies were to be made available to acquire interest in land or water as an eligible piece of restoring watersheds, improving salmon habitat, water quality. And so in 1999, when OWEB was created, the statute that identifies eligible grant applicants and eligible types of activities that my board's allowed to fund includes in the list acquisition of interest in land or water. We have put in place rules. I will tell you it's the single most controversial part of my program. Representative Krupp and I have spent a lot of time talking about this. And Senator Meserle frequently nods his head and says you're in between a rock and a hard place on this, because there are very clear philosophical lines about using public funds for acquisition. OWEB, by constitutional amendment and by statute, nonetheless, does. And this is how we do it. It is an eligible grant application. It comes in the door, and OWEB does not take ownership of the property, doesn't advocate or seek out acquisitions, but handles applications that come in to acquire interest in land. And that can be anything from a fee simple purchase to a conservation easement. It has to be between a willing seller and willing buyer. And we run it through our process, a three-step process. First, we look to see what's the ecological bang for the buck of doing this acquisition. What is the ecological merit of the proposal? We do a due diligence examination, and we require as part of the application to have an appraisal, a fair market value appraisal. And then the first thing that happens is the board, I go out and hire an independent appraiser to represent the OWEB board to review all of the appraisal and due diligence work that has been submitted by the applicant to feel comfortable that we have a, even though we have a willing seller, willing buyer, we have an appropriate purchase price and a number of other things. And then we also look at whether there's community support or concern about the proposed grant application that's pending in front of us. We combine those three things together and have an explicit discussion in front of the full OWEB board of every single acquisition application, with a recommendation coming from me rather than from the regional teams on whether or not overall those three components accomplish a project that will further the watershed restoration goals that OWEB is charged with administering. As part of reviewing that application, also the board looks to see whether there is adequate dollars available to sustain the long-term management of the property after it's acquired. And the OWEB board also looks to who's going to hold title to the property, because obviously when this conveyance occurs, someone has to hold the title. Most of the acquisitions that we see and that we have had occur end up with title being held by Parks Department or a large conservation organization or a county commission. We have had a very small piece of our business in the last 2 years has been acquisitions. Actually, since OWEB has been created in 3 years, I think we've had a little, about 25 to 27 acquisition applications that have come in the door out of well over 1,000 restoration project applications. Out of the 27, we have approved 9, and we're still waiting to see if the ninth approval, the applicant can satisfy the conditions the board put on it in order for us to actually fund it. So we've actually approved 8. In the back of this green book, toward the back, there's a two-page spread that shows where we've done every acquisition in the state and generally what we look to when we are doing acquisitions, page 38. And the last thing I'd say about acquisitions of land interests is that when OWEB funds an acquisition, regardless of who's going to hold title or whether it's a conservation easement or a fee simple acquisition, we take a lien on title that is recorded with the deed that identifies the conservation purposes that led to the investment of public dollars. And we have a right of reversion on that property so that if at any time in the future the management of the property becomes inconsistent with the purposes that underlie the investment that the OWEB board made, the state has a right to step in and ask for the property to be managed in a way that's consistent with those Measure 66 dollars. The OWEB board also retains the right to be involved, both by statute but also by board condition, that if after investing in it, sometime down the road, the entity holding title decides they want to sell the property, that sale has to be approved by the OWEB board. And we can decide not to allow the sale, or we can identify whether we think it's being sold to an entity that we're comfortable can sustain the purposes of Measure 66. And there's a no profit on that sale. And Representative Krupp worked with me in the last legislative session to put what the OWEB practice had been into statute. But if there is in the future, and we haven't had this occur, but a turnover of something that we've invested in, then by recorded deed, we will be involved in that transaction, both to ensure the underlying purpose of the investment is sustained and the profit isn't occurring as a result of the original investment of public funds. To date, for all of the conversation and controversy we have about acquisitions as a program and the different philosophical views, we've had really very little, if no, conflict over any single acquisition that OWEB has been involved in. There are a number of acquisitions that are occurring with different entities in this state with different levels of controversy around them, but so far we have managed to find win-win solutions, again, where it made sense to folks that were involved at a local level, and the dollars and cents added up, and the long-term management could be sustained. So that's the sum total of acquisitions.
Thank you.
I have some questions for you, Jeff. And they're kind of just reflective of your entire presentation today, so I will try to make sense of them in some order, logically. We're hearing occasionally of news stories that evolve out of state agencies in terms of management issues, $190 an hour consultants to keep a particular agency's upper management meetings flowing at a more reasonable level. You guys involved in anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of, Chair
okay.
Krupp. It's a small enough agency that we very little happens that every one of us don't know is happening as a staff. We can still all fit in the same room and get on the same telephone conference call and talk. And in fact, I do that with my staff every other week. Every staff person I have sits around a table or on the phone and we talk about what's happening. And every week I talk with my field folks that aren't in Salem. And we try to run our organization as a what's the dollar invested for what product and what was the outcome that occurred from the last time we did it and how are we getting that money to facilitate what's happening locally, not driven out of Salem.
Okay, very good. In one of the publications that you have shared with us here today, and I think it was actually your comments from your speech that you gave mm-hmm. in regards to the positive economic impact of the dollars that we're spending and the effort that's it's being engaged in here. You talk about on your first page about towards the bottom of the first column down here.
Mm-hmm.
talking about commercial timber industry alone, you've estimated $50 million in private funds that have been invested since 97 and another commitment of $80 million by 2007. While that is clearly part of your matching funds initiative, where you try to achieve a ratio of 2-to-1, which is certainly laudable, and I appreciate that. I'm wondering how much of this money that private enterprise or commercial enterprise is investing is a result of ESA requirements, is a result of Oregon plan concepts, the Oregon Forest Practices Act. In other words, what I'm driving at is this really attributable to matching funds and good ideas from OWEB through watershed enhancement councils, or is it really being driven by mandates from the federal government, and this is a way that they can comply with those mandates?
Chair Krupp, you raised a couple of really good points and point out a need for me to clarify something. That 2-to-1 match ratio is just for OWEB grants. And the notion of the identification of what the commercial timber industry investment has been and is charted to be is separate from the OWEB grants, or a portion of it may include OWEB involvement. But that portion of the speech was intended to identify that there is so much that's happening out there that doesn't involve OWEB and, in fact, is being taken on by the timber industry and the agricultural landowners in the state without the need for the public dollars, that it is in addition to where our program intersects with their efforts. The timber industry in particular has laid out a 10-year plan of making investments on lands, and those dollar figures came from a publication by the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, which has a wonderful Oregon plan publication, actually, that we'll try to put in the hands of the committee that talks a lot about that. For the second part of your question, in terms of those specific dollars and that 10-year plan, I really would like to defer to a representative of the timber industry to talk to you specifically about it. But separate from that, on a more generic level, there is substantial investment going on that OWEB's involved in that is entirely voluntary, and there's nothing that we fund that is mandated that it has to be done under an administrative order or a court order or a regulatory requirement. That said, part of the entire notion of the Oregon Plan is taking control of our destiny before it is grabbed away, either for an individual landowner or on behalf of our resource sectors, industries in the state or the state itself, by seeing what's coming down the road and identifying what we can do in order to change practices, make improvements as we're doing routine maintenance, and doing that added increment so that we insulate ourselves as landowners or as industries from mandates later on. If OWEB is involved with a specific grant application, it is because it is a voluntary project that is not mandated by law. But if OWEB is involved when it's in any context that's related to Senate Bill 1010 or improving fish passage requirement or whatever, there's clearly that notion out there that we have obligations that have to be lived up to in the future, lest somebody begin to decide that they want to help begin to manage our farm or tell us what has to be done with our water diversion or whatever. So it is part of grabbing hold of where we're going. One of the statistics that was not in the portion of the speech that was excerpted that I think is really important, the Oregon State University looked at in November what percentage of the jobs in Oregon are directly associated with our traditional natural resources industries. And 13.9% of the jobs in Oregon are directly associated with the traditional natural resource industries of our state, including tourism. And that percentage jumps to over 26% when the jobs that are indirectly dependent on those natural resource industries are included. So there are indirect jobs that are dependent on the natural resource sectors that actually bumps it up to 26%. That's a substantial portion of Oregon's economy. And the Oregon plan, I would submit, is part of saying we can do better than living with federal mandates and how they'll intersect those sectors of the Oregon economy, and we can grab hold of the our destiny, and we can move through investments and collaboration on privately owned lands and every watershed around the state in ways that can help sustain the jobs that are associated with this sector of our economy and sustain it over the long term. That's the trick. But it is a real tangible piece. I think the Oregon Plan is a real tangible piece of economic recovery for the state. And when we talk about the Oregon Plan and talk about making that work, a piece of that clearly is investments, having a pot of money that's available so that when landowners want to take on something that will help them control their destiny, there's money available to do it instead of having to deal with a program. And that's our hope. And on our best days, we're successful. And there's obviously a lot of things that I could do better and that my agency probably doesn't do well. But on our best days, that's what we accomplish, and that's what we're trying to shoot for.
Very good. Do you offer grants to cities who need to upgrade their infrastructure for water quality issues in compliance with any Clean Water Act issues? I mean, you sort of answered that a moment ago, talking about you really don't fund mandate issues other than you do help with some Senate Bill 1010 water quality monitoring issues. I mean, do you guys provide grants for cities that have some real problems with perhaps sewage overflows, contamination issues that are somewhat harmful to fish populations and water quality?
Chair Krupp, that's outside of our niche. Having said that, there's nothing. I'm constantly amazed at the partnerships that can be created that match core functions that communities need to get done with also helping to make a real difference in the water quality or restoring the watershed. So it wouldn't surprise me if there is an opportunity that either has already occurred that I'm not thinking about or that will come up in the future where a community is able to match something they have to do for Clean Water Act purposes as part of managing a wastewater treatment system that will help augment flows or do a water conservation or something that could enhance fish habitat or the water quality in a voluntary way too. I know that we're working, for instance, with a developer in Portland right now, headwaters of Tryon Creek. He is working with a number of organizations in the city to create a new housing development, affordable housing for seniors. It is on a location that is redeveloping an old unused lot. The stream was put in a tunnel. Tryon Creek was put into a tunnel and piped underground some time ago. That developer came to us and said, hey, we would like to make this a showcase that combines a lot of things, but one of the things we'd like to combine here is daylighting that creek, making it so that it provides cool water to Johnson Creek, which we know that everybody has an interest in, and we'd like OWEB to help partner on a piece of this development.
Mr. Chair, I just want to follow up, actually, because there were a couple instances that I know of. One is the DEQ administers the state revolving loan fund, which is low interest loans to municipalities so they can meet the Clean Water Act. But last night we were both at the fairly new Oregon Garden, and there are some real innovative techniques that are being used. The city of Silverton actually runs their, I think they're doing tertiary treatment at the Oregon Gardens with their wastewater treatment because they couldn't get a permit to discharge into the creek that's right there. So basically that was part of how the Oregon Garden also, because they couldn't get a water rights permit to meet their needs in the summertime. So there was this symbiotic relationship that was formed. And so last night, although we couldn't see it, and I know you've been there, there's a series of constructed wetlands, and that's, I think, an example. I know that there was, John McDonald told me, $15,000 worth of money from the conservation districts went to that project, and I don't know if there was any OWEB funds that went to that.
OWEB did fund a project with the Silverton the Gardens. I'm not exactly sure what the project was that we did with them, so I don't know if it's that particular one. And I have in my deep recollection that we also worked with the city of Corvallis on a tertiary project in some capacity or another, although I'm not.
Yeah, I know the city of Lebanon actually has a proposal they put together to do something very similar. It's in the old Morse Brothers property across the river, and it's a natural flow type dissemination system that it's really innovative and creative. It's very unusual, and they're looking for, it's going to be very expensive, but they're looking for money to try that as a project. It's an interesting idea.
Well, we'd be happy to talk to them.
Okay. I'll pass that along to them, actually. That would be fine. Are you seeing an increase in the use of conservation easements through your organization in the last couple of years or so? Is that becoming a more popular tool, I guess, of trying to achieve some of the results that people want with...
Mr. Chair, we're seeing a lot more discussion about the conservation easements that I think will lead toward more business with conservation easements, but we're also seeing the reality check that comes in with that, where folks are struggling through, well, how do you value the easement and how do you and what's in and what's out, and how do you provide for other use of the property? And so it's from my view, falling out on, like, all these anything that is with an acquisition, it comes down to parcel by parcel whether it fits and how it can be valued and what works for the landowner that's going to be there next and the one that wants to continue working. I have had one conservation easement that was applied for with OWEB that would have just been a conservation easement, and we had some real appraisal issues and perceptions by the landowner of what was being given up versus what the appraisal could pencil out was left us as the fee simple title that would be remaining in the value of that, and it ultimately didn't happen. But we're working on some methodology with, I think, Oregon State University to help us do that, so it'll be a little more standardized approach, and I think that we'll see more of that type of business than the other in the future.
Very good. Members, additional questions from Jeff? Yeah, well, we've got about 20 minutes left. Jeff, anything else you want to share with us today?
I'm finished, Mr. Chair, except for one thing, and I wanted to show you this because we'll be back. This is where we'll spend the time on Tuesday and Thursday of next week. The Oregon Plan Biennial Report. In case you don't have enough to do and you don't have enough reading, if you get a chance to thumb through this, it is, I think, a huge step forward for us. The first half of the document goes through the state, basin by basin, and I wish I'll catch Representative Cruz because it goes to one of his questions, and it shows what kind of projects are happening, where they're happening, cumulatively and both just in the last 2 years. It shows the kinds of activities being funded. You know, is it fish passage or is it riparian area enhancement? It shows who's doing the funding, and whether it's private investment or public investment. For the first time, we also, on each of these basin layouts, show where are the listed fish, where are the water quality listed streams, and why are streams listed as water quality limited in this particular basin. What's the reason? It shows what are the different federal agencies putting in that basin in terms of amount of money, and where is it going? And it shows the private sector contribution also over time. It also has some shaded boxes that talk about, based on what we're hearing from the soil and water conservation districts and the counties and the watershed councils and the local landowners, what are the issues and the challenges that are being faced in that basin in order to really implement the Oregon Plan? What are the hurdles we have to get over, and what are some of the key accomplishments? And then, more on a science level, what are the key restoration issues? Is it fish passage in the basin, or is it water quantity flow in the stream? So the first half of the document goes through for each of 15 basins. Then the second half of the document is the structure we're going to use for the discussion next week, and it's the four-legged stool of the Oregon Plan. We'll talk about the agency actions, and there's a layout. What's happening with agency actions implementing the Oregon Plan? Voluntary restoration actions, monitoring, and the science oversight, the independent science panel. So this is the first time since 1997 that we've actually grabbed hold and tried to quantify the implementation efforts that are going on. It's not an OEB-specific document, but there's a large piece of what you're beginning to grab hold of in this committee with the Oregon Plan that is we try to lay out both spatially and then programmatically for you. I appreciate your patience. I know I was a talking head for a long time this morning, and you had some very good questions, and I thank you for the time and the opportunity to come in, and I'll look forward to talking to you individually and again over the session.
Well, Jeff, for someone who's not had a lot of sleep, you've done a great job today. We appreciate that. And at this point in time, hearing no further business, we'll actually close our informational hearing today. And members, we do need to just let you know that we're going to pass out the formal rules that we did adopt. We hadn't done that at this time, so that we have that in our possession. And with that, we will see you on Tuesday, bright and early at 8:30 a.m., and we are adjourned.